And now let's put our hands together and welcome Tim W. from Santa Barbara.
My name's Tim Whitcomb. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober today. I want to thank Steve for hosting me. He's done a good job of it, I want you all to know. You know, if you get invited to do this kind of thing, the quality of the care and attention you get varies pretty widely, you know. But Steve's done a good job. He's followed up on phone calls and made sure I knew where I was going and met me here and had my tickets in my room and everything ready. And he called me about 20 minutes ago and said, "You're coming down, aren't you?" And it might have been a good thing that he did, because I was debating that question about that time. Should I go? Should I not go? You know? Want to thank David Figueroa for inviting me. I am a little worried about Dave. He's heard me speak before, and yet he invited me down here to speak. You know? But when he did, I reflected on the two sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were on death row. They were working a program, but paying the price for the acts that they'd done in their lives. And as the time approached for their sentence to be carried out, the warden came to them and said he was impressed by what he'd seen them do. He'd been watching them, and he was impressed, and that if it was within his power to grant any last wishes for them, he'd be happy to do so. And the first man said, "Warden, I'd like to have the opportunity to tell my story one more time in the hope that it might help somebody else." The warden said, "I'll see what I can do." And the second man said, "Warden, I'd like you to execute me immediately, because if I have to listen to that son of a bitch tell that story..." I don't know. I never know what I'm going to say when I get up here. I don't have a set thing that I do. I can guarantee you this much: the talk I give here this morning will not be nearly as good as the one I gave in the shower getting ready to come down here. That one was crisp. I wish several of you could have been there for it. Now, you'll notice I wasn't looking at anybody when I said that. That's just an old joke I've used a lot of times trying to get comfortable up here, but I delivered that line one time and realized I was staring right into somebody's eyes when I said it, and I'm pretty sure I made that guy nervous. You know? He was new and wondering what he'd got himself into. You know? I recognize a lot of the faces in this room. I realize that primarily I'm preaching to the choir this morning, which I don't mind, but I wish there were. Welcome, Greg. Is it Greg? Yeah, welcome. Hospital and institution is a lifesaver, truly is, in many ways. Dr. Bob, in his last talk, said there would be a few things on which it was advisable to lay a little emphasis. One is to remember the simplicity of our program. Let's not mess it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have little to do with our actual AA service. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. and love and service in hospital and institution is a unique and special and rewarding way, has been for me. You know, when I'm sober since January the 3rd, 1983, so I just celebrated 31 years of sobriety. I have a home group, men who have lost their legs. We meet on Thursday nights in Santa Barbara at the Vets Building. And I have a sponsor, his name's Rick Mohan, and Rick has 54 years of continuous sobriety. And he's a good guy. He's just a peaceful man and a man of few words. We were talking about him this morning at breakfast, and I like him a lot. So when I was about 15 years sober, I got two phone calls almost back to back asking me to come to conferences like this and do the H&I talk. And they were one weekend and then the next weekend. I mean, just back-to-back conferences. And I really got kind of tweaked about it because I thought, I do H&I. I mean, I have panels, but I'm not an H&I talker per se. I don't know that much about it to educate or elucidate or, you know, enlighten anybody, really. But it occurred to me that I knew someone who perhaps could. His name was Jack Prose. And I called Jack. And I said, here's the situation. He said, hey, come on down. So I went down to his house, and we sat together for a couple of hours. And he kind of laid it out. I'd heard his pitch before, parts of it. Parts of the H&I ingredients in his pitch. But we talked about it. And the one thing I came away from out of that talk, and the main thing, and I want to share this with, especially with you, Greg, is that Jack looked at me very clearly, shall we say, and said, Tim, people who do H&I work stay sober. And then he said it again, people who do H&I work stay sober. I think Jack was 50 plus years sober at the time, so I thought, well, I'll take your word for it, Jack, you know. And as I say, I know I'm preaching to the choir primarily this morning, but I just want to remind all of us that people who do H&I work stay sober. You know, we have these wonderful experiences. We get to build these relationships with people. I grew up down in this area. I was born in Santa Monica. And when I was seven, we moved to Van Nuys. My dad worked in Burbank at an aircraft plant, and we moved out on Satakoy right off of Sepulveda. Yeah. That's where I grew up. And I ran all over this valley. It's where I had my first drinks. It's where I used my first drugs. You know, I remember, here's the thing about, it took me getting sober to realize this. I thought, I didn't like alcohol when I was young. And what that really means is, every time I used it when I was young, I would somehow manage to overshoot the mark with it. You know, I didn't realize that there were probably people around me that were having their two little cans of that country club malt liquor and copping a buzz and stopping. You know, I just kept going. And I didn't have any idea how to control or enjoy it, so I'd get sick and I'd end up puking. And the things that we do, I'd get beat up or, you know, fall down somewhere. So, you know, I really wasn't a big fan of drinking. but I got introduced to other outside issues. A guy named Little Joe, member of the Satan Slaves, said, man, you got to try smoking some of this. And then we're sitting in this old Chevy of his, and we're passing this thing around, and I'm not feeling anything, and I'm going, hey, I don't feel anything. I don't feel it. Whoa, wait a minute. I feel something. And we took off riding in that car, and I'd ridden in it a lot of times before. I knew it didn't have any shocks or springs, and all of a sudden it's on air cushions, you know. We're doing a fast 15 miles an hour down the road, and we went to Beep's Hamburgers on the corner of Sherman Way and Woodley. And this is how long ago this was. They were selling hamburgers five for a dollar. I had five. Because they'd done something new with the recipe, you know. These things were good. Wasn't too long after that, somebody threw a handful of pills in my hand and said, try these. And I went, what were they? And he said, those are 10 grain Benzedrine tablets. I said, what are they going to do? He said, just hold on. You'll find out. About 10 minutes later, all the hair on the back of my head went, let me tell you the story of my life. I like the speed. You could drink behind it. Now all of a sudden I like drinking because I wasn't getting sick. I was able to cop that buzz that alcohol would give you and not overshoot the mark with it, because the other substance would keep me motivated. I had just turned 19 years old when I shot and killed my older brother in a fight over drugs. We weren't fighting about the possession of them, we were fighting about the way I used them. And he thought, you know, we'd had a lot of fights in our lives, and he always won. And he thought one more time he was going to beat me up and make me do something I didn't want to do, which was stop using dope. And I had a pistol, and I used it. I was convicted of the crime of second-degree murder. I committed that crime while under the influence of alcohol and narcotics. That's not an excuse, that's just the facts. I took those drugs and drank that drink very willingly. So I realized today that I'm responsible for what I do. But they sent me upstate. I had an A number, if that means anything to anybody. I was in the joint from 1964 to 1969. I did 5 years on that beef. Never drew a sober breath in prison if I could help it. They were doing a lot of better living through chemistry in the state of California at that time. So they started medicating us to alter our moods and behaviors. And I took what they prescribed for me, and I took what they prescribed for you, and threw a little of that homemade wine on top of it all, and let's see what that'll do. Yeah. I can remember coming to in my cell one time, and the entire goon squad was in there with me. You know, I came out of whatever blackout I'd been in. Uh-oh. This don't look good, you know. And they hauled me off to the hole, and you know, it's just the price you pay. But one important thing happened. A lot of things happened, but one important thing, only in retrospect did I realize how important it was. There was a guy who celled next to me, and he said, hey man, you go to that writer's group, which I did. I attended the writer's group because I was a poet. And we had some free people that would come into those meetings. He said, I go to AA. He says, why don't you invite me to your group and I'll invite you to mine, and that way we can spread our hustle. You know, we'll get out of the cell more. We'll mingle with the free people. Some of them are women, you know, real women. And, I went to my first AA meeting somewhere 1965, 66, 67, 68, somewhere in there. I went to a bunch of them, really. I was always stoned, and I always would sit in the back with my yard coat all buttoned up to my neck and my shades on at night, and I came to scoff, and I did not remain to pray. In the interest of honesty, I should also mention that, you know, I've read the stuff that I wrote, and I was actually not a poet. It kind of ran the gamut from maudlin self-obsession to very poor imitations of Bob Dylan. But I would scribble.
Getting bugged about this microphone.
It's not a mic. It's not a mic. It's a recording device. There's no.
Are you having trouble hearing me?
I'm fine.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yes.
Well, I'll try and speak up. I am an actor. I know how to project. Sorry. Should I start over?
We got time.
I was born at a very young age. Thank you, David. I liked the AA meetings that I went to. I thought Chuck Chamberlain came in there and talked one time. And he was funny and articulate, and some of the other convicts had been sober a while, and they could really talk that talk. And there was a lot of laughter. I remembered that, and this feeling of camaraderie. And my reaction was, I'm really glad these people got this thing for themselves, because to listen to them tell their stories, they need it. I was not an alcoholic. I just had a series of bad breaks and unfortunate circumstances and people who didn't understand. That was the problem. When I look back, after I finally got sober, I realized I'd had about 38 years of bad breaks and unfortunate circumstances and people who didn't understand. It was always out there was where the problem lie. It was never in here. So when I got out, I got strung out immediately. I have a friend who's now sober 36 years, Billy B., out of Venice, who told me at some point, you know, you shouldn't take all those pills. Why don't you have a few drinks and mellow out? Now, when I finally hit Alcoholics Anonymous, I called Billy and he says, yeah, man, I got 5 years. I said, well, you might have told me it was time to stop, you know. But I was just doing what I was doing. I had some more scrapes with the law, but I never went back to jail or I never went back to prison. And I ended up homeless on the streets of Sacramento. Wine drunk all the time. I wasn't shooting dope anymore. All I was doing was drinking, because I had learned how to drink real well by then. And it had taken me to that place in my life. And I was tramping around with this guy named Bob. And he said, we were drunk somewhere, and he says, we're dying, you know that? And I said, yeah, I don't care. He said, I'll tell you what, man, I get a little money at the first of the month. Why don't we go to Santa Barbara and get sober? And I said, sure. Now, Bob could have said, why don't we go to Denver and get drunk? And I would have said, sure. You know? I had focused in on the fact he got a little money at the first of the month. This was new information. But he was a man of his word, and he bought us bus tickets when he got his little check. And we rode down to Santa Barbara, drunk on the trip, and drunk in that town for a couple of days. And then we got separated. We got separated because he wanted to go somewhere. I remember he was in a highly agitated state. And we need to go here. We need to go do something. And I said, Bob, if I stand up, I'm going to fall down, which was the truth. I was real drunk. He says, okay, I'll catch up with you later. And he went weaving off, and I didn't see him for 6 weeks. And 6 weeks later, when I saw him, I was 6 weeks sober. I was 6 weeks sober because on the trip down there, he said, we'll go to AA meetings when we get down there. And I said, oh, AA, I know about that. I went when I was in the joint. I didn't really know, but at least I was familiar. So when I went looking for Bob, I called central office. And I said, have you seen Bob? And this woman said, I know a few Bobs, honey, and how are you doing? And we talked a little bit, and I hung up the phone and went and drank some more, and then I walked up there. Because I thought maybe Bob will be there by now. And I met Gertrude, who was running our central office at the time. She said, oh, you're that man looking for his friend. I still haven't seen him, but you know, I know some guys who just love to talk to you. What do you think? Sure. And I began my trip into sobriety. I got sober living at the Salvation Army at the ARC. I managed to get checked in there. Place looked like heaven, man. You know, off the street, out of the cold, out of the wet. It only took maybe a month before it didn't look quite as appealing, you know. But in those days, when you checked in, you were restricted to the residence and your job assignment for a week. And then after that, your free time in the evening was your own. Well, the first night I was free to go out on my own, I'm not sure what might have happened. There were a few possibilities, but I'll tell you what did happen. There was a guy waiting at the door that I'd met a week before at the club saying, hey, I knew you were getting out tonight and I'm going to an AA meeting, thought maybe you'd like to go with me. His name was Dave Crane. And I went, sure. And he took me to this meeting and I hated it. It was full of good-looking, cheerful, friendly people, seemingly at ease with themselves and their surroundings, chatting comfortably, and they were a little condescending. I thought they brought me the half cup of coffee, and Dave had given me the big book a week before, so I was waiting for him to call on me to share because I'd read that thing. I didn't remember any of it, but I'd read it, and I was going to enlighten everybody, you know. But they did say, welcome to the newcomer. I thought, well, at least they recognize greatness when it enters the room, you know. And then on the way back, Dave was taking me back to the residence, and I did something that was unusual for me. I told him what I was thinking. I said, Dave, I'm thinking about taking a drink. I thought he was going to be shocked. He said, I don't want to get drunk. I don't want to go back to the street. I don't want to, you know, all the things that were just happening a week ago. That's not, but I'm feeling a lot better. And I think maybe there's some chance I may not be an alcoholic. And he told me something I've never forgotten. He said, Tim, it's not up to me to tell you if you're an alcoholic or not. That's a decision you'll have to make for yourself. He said, but you've been around long enough already to know that if you are an alcoholic, for you to take that drink's a very dangerous thing. And, he said, if you're not an alcoholic, you don't have to worry about it, because people who aren't alcoholic don't sit around and try and figure out whether they can drink or not. I said, huh, let me think about that. You know? And I went back in the residence, and I woke up in the morning, and I was an alcoholic again, and then I wasn't later that day, and then I was that night. And you know what I'm talking about. I mean, this thing, the one thing I did right was I didn't drink. I was introduced to hospital and institution very early. I had one of those sponsors who, he never told me to do anything. If I made a request, he would try to honor it. If I, you know, said, hey, I think it's time for me to move on to the next step, he'd say, fine, I agree. Or maybe we should continue to look at what we've been doing. But he sort of made me drive that train. And therefore, I think it meant more to me, because I was motivated. But he did a lot of stuff. You know, he was one of those guys who was busy in AA. He was a greeter at our meeting, stand at the head of the stairs and shake everybody's hand. He was the chairperson of the steering committee. You know, he went places and he spoke. I remember him talking to me about Hawaii, and I said, oh, well, I want to go to Hawaii and speak. And he said, you know, that may come someday. But here's what you need to remember. If you want to go to Hawaii, you've got to go to Bakersfield. I've been to Bakersfield a bunch of times, man. I'm still waiting for that call from the islands. You know, they moved. When I lived there, this Salvation Army, the ARC, was in Santa Barbara. I was with them for 2 years as an employee. And then I managed to get myself fired, which isn't easy. My sponsor had suggested, I told him I was getting unhappy with my job, and he said, why don't you pray about the area of your employment? So I started praying, and 2 weeks later I was fired. I thought, well, wait, that can't be it. And then I ran to my sponsor. I said, they fired me. And he said, well, what would you do if you had a choice? And I said, well, I'd like to work at the university, but I've had an application in out there for months and I haven't heard anything from them. And he said, oh, I know somebody out there. Let me make a call. And the next day I had an interview, and the day after that I went to work. Wow, this prayer stuff works, you know. I worked for them for a year, and I realized it wasn't what I wanted to do. And the difference with that was I went to them and said, thank you for this opportunity. I'm giving you 2 weeks' notice now. I'm going to be leaving. Let me know what I can do to be of service and help in that time, and anything that you require of me. And thanks a lot for what you've done for me. And then I left. It's kind of like being a grown-up, almost, you know. And about that time, they had moved the ARC down to Carpinteria, the next town below us, and they had begun to formulate more of a program there. And one of the things they did was they wanted AA meetings in there. So I got a panel, and I started every Wednesday for about 20 years. I would take a speaker in on Wednesday night. These guys got to hear some fantastic people, you know, Doug Rowell, Carla Rowell, I mean, these hotshot AA speaker people, you know, would come and talk to these guys. Larry Thomas, Jeff Callen, and about every 6 months, because of the turnover in personnel, shall we say, the clients there, I would speak myself. And I always told them the same thing. This is a wonderful place and a wonderful opportunity for you. And if you play it right, you never have to come back here again except to talk. You know, God bless the Salvation Army. Step up off of the street, get you going, give you a good little foundation to opportunity to go to a lot of AA meetings. Took me 7 years into my sobriety before they would let me into the prisons. But the minute they would, I started going. I think there's, just like the Sally, I think there's something special, not more important, not more, I don't know, just something special about being able to say to someone, I was here, just like you are here, and I'm not here anymore. So I've had the opportunity to do that in a number of prisons now. I'm a killer who did his time and got out and have managed to stay out. And I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found a way of life that is rich and full and rewarding. And you can have that life too. Please come and see us when you get out, if you get out. I go into the United States Penitentiary at Lompoc with my good friend Steve G. Thanks for coming down with me, Steve. I appreciate the company. And I've been going in there for a long time. And I was there for the golden age of Lompoc, we call it, when there was a big group, up to 50 guys that would attend on a regular basis. And at that point in time, it was a United States penitentiary, which has to do with the security levels and how hard that yard is. At some point, they downgraded it to an FCI, Federal Correctional Institution. And now the clientele is not doing nearly as much time. And lo and behold, they're not nearly as much interested in AA. The attendance has fallen off a lot. But there's a little core group of guys that comes. And Steve and I run around together a lot. We go places, we do things. And we were at a conference in Yosemite, I believe, where we ran across a group of guys who had a format for their meeting that we were impressed by. And Steve said, hey, let's try that up at the joint. So we've just, for about 2 months now, we've been reading the big book with these guys. And they're starting to catch fire with it. Because they were just kind of having meetings where they would sit around and talk. And the talk was pretty much always the same. But we managed to suggest that we add a little structure to this and some literature to help us, you know, the direction that we want to take things or talk about, the things we want to talk about, and they're liking it. So thanks for that, Steve, because that was a good idea and it seems to be working. My own panel is at a place called CMC East. That's a level 3 yard in the state prison system. Most of the guys are lifers. And they have been in a long time. I never lose sight of the fact that a lot of them did exactly the same crime I did or something very similar to it, and that they're doing a lot longer time than I had to do. That's just been a change in the political climate. I always tell them the same thing, you know, I'm real glad to be here and I'm real glad I get to leave. And I took a little girl, a young lady, up with me recently. It was her first time. And she had sort of the typical reaction in a way. We walked out afterwards and she said, I just wish they could all get out. And I said, no, you don't. You know? I know they were nice to you, honey, but there are people there that I hope never see the light of day. I don't want them living in my world. But there are also people there who are, you know, they did just what I did. They were liquored up and they had a gun or they had a knife or they had their bare hands and they took somebody's life. And now they're living in that regret. I talked to a guy the last time I was up there. This one got to me. He's been down in there 25 years. And what's the button I'm supposed to push? This one? I got it, 1056. Oh, we got a lot of time. You'll be sorry to hear. He's been in there 25 years now. He killed two people in a vehicular accident. One of them was a total stranger. The other one was his best friend. And he said the reason the parole board gives him so much trouble about setting a date for his release is that they feel he's not taking responsibility for his actions. And they feel he's not taking responsibility because he quite honestly keeps telling them every time, I don't remember doing it. All I remember was I was doing this. And then I woke up in a cell and they told me I'd killed a couple of people. And I don't remember it. I drove drunk thousands of times. I'm guessing some of you did too, you know. I'm not sure I ever once stopped and thought, geez, you know, I'm impaired. This probably isn't a good idea. My thing was, I drive better when I've had a few, you know. So at 7 years, a guy named Bob Kiernan took me into CMC, and I was very nervous just about going back in, because, you know, if you've ever heard those gates clang behind you, you know that sound and that feeling and I had this mistaken idea that I was going to educate people. I was going to go enlighten them about sobriety. And we got inside and I started talking to some of the guys during the break period where we have a chance to fellowship. And it turned out that a lot of them were sober longer than me. And they were sober all that time inside. I never drew a sober breath in prison. So I know that it's harder to do in some ways to be sober in there, because the tendency is to want to get out of yourself. If you can't get out of there, at least get out of yourself. And these guys are doing it under extremely difficult conditions, working a program. You know, I remember a night where a guy, during the convict portion of the meeting, a guy got up and he had just been denied parole for a couple of years, and he was kind of boo-hooing about it a little, and understandably, you know, he'd been in a long time, he was a lifer, and now he's got two more years to do at least. And he sat down, and the next guy that got up said, "My name's Andy, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm doing life without the possibility of parole, and what I find it necessary to do is practice the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life so that I can live comfortably no matter where I am." And I turned to the people I was with and said, "We can go home now. You know, I've heard everything I need to hear." Just truly impressive, amazing stuff happens. You know, I had Larry Thomas cleared to go in. He came up from Torrance. I was so excited. The guys were going to get to hear Larry. And we got there and they said, "Oh, fog's in. We've got them all locked down. We can't see from tower to tower, so we've locked them down and you can't go in." And I was so disappointed. And it took me a little while to get over it, but I finally realized, man, we'd had a great meeting in the car on the way up there. We had a great meeting in the car on the way back. So it's not all peaches and cream, and it's not all wonderful, and, you know, they don't all pick up their beds and walk. But I love doing the work. I love doing the work. I remember hearing Vic say one time, "You can have my panel when you can pry it from my cold, dead hands." And I thought, yeah, that's the attitude I want to have. Because I love what I do. Yeah. So some of these lifers, there's been a little break in that log jam. Some of them are getting out. We've had some come home. We do what we can to follow up. You know, when we're in there talking to them, I always tell them the same thing. If you're an alcoholic of my variety, especially, come to Alcoholics Anonymous when you get out of here. You know, we're not an employment agency. We're not a dating service. We're not a lot of things, although those things do sometimes happen. But you'll find a group of people who will welcome you and make you feel as though you're part of something, and hopefully not judge you. You know, my wife always says, "Is that Pat Higgins? Hello, Pat. Hi, Mike." More desperados. Just I love you guys. You're late. I would have missed half of this too if it, you know. My wife always mentions, you know, what does a person do who's been in prison for 30 years? And all of a sudden they're out and their family's gone. And when they left the world, there was no internet. And now the world's going a lot faster than it used to. And, you know, they hand them $200 at the gate and say, "Go see your parole officer." It's not, you know, I don't know what some people do, quite honestly. It can't be easy. But the ones that have come to us, the vast majority of them, are doing well. Not all of them. You know, we had a guy get out who got into the fellowship and in a big way and then ended up stealing a bunch of money. Now, there's a surprise, you know. Guy was a thief. And but that's the exception to the rule. Most of the guys that have gotten out that I've known, that the lifers especially, are just, they sort of kiss the ground that they're walking on every day. You know, the door handle's on the inside, they can open the door, they can walk outside, they can, and they've been made welcome within our fellowship. They've been, you know, the hand of AA has been there. So thank all of you for that. You know, thank all of you for, you know, Dusty Brocious took me into, when I was growing up here in the Valley, I spent a couple of years in a place called Pacific Lodge Home for Boys when I was 13, 14, and 15 years old. The court sent me there, and Dusty took me on a panel there. You know, got to revisit, you know, my old haunts. And I loved it. I loved the kids. They didn't listen to a damn thing I said, you know. They were busy doing what kids do, and I started to get offended, and then realized, there I am. That was me. Here's some old guy. Yamity, 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 yamity. But as a lot of you know who've been around for a while, you know, we just get up and say things and kind of leave the results up to God, hopefully. And I've certainly had the experience of people coming up to me sometimes years later and saying, hey, you know, you said this 5 years ago, and I just got it. Now I understand what you're talking about. And I've had that experience of listening to these old guys going, oh, wait, he's, man, now all of a sudden, ooh, I'm getting it. So, I was up at CMC one night and this guy came up during the break and said, hey man, you ever see these chips with like 60 days on them? It says 60. Not the metal chips. We can't have metal. These look like poker chips. It's like, yeah, Donnie, I've seen them. Well, you think you can find out where we can get some, how much they cost? Well, sure I can. You know, I work at Central Office. I'll be happy to find out for you. But Donnie, you're 12 years sober. What do you need with a 60-day chip? He said, oh, no, man, it's not for me. He said, "What? The thing is, there's a whole cell block full of guys here who have alcoholism and problems other than alcoholism. They're bipolar and manic depressive and schizophrenic, and they won't let them come out to go to this meeting. So what we started doing is taking meetings into them, because that's how we do our H&I work, man. We got them the chips. Every once in a while, one of those guys gets to feeling better, and he comes out, and he's like, look, 60 days, 90 days, got my little plastic chip. These experiences are things that I could have missed, you know. Could have missed all this. I've had a great 31 years so far, grown and changed, and I'm definitely not the man who walked in here. I'm a different guy today. I've had the great blessing of living two lives in one lifetime. You know, I was one guy, and now I'm another one. I see it all as a direct result of hanging out with folks like you, learning what I learned from you, and making sure that when the hand of AA is asked for, reached out for, that I'm responsible for it being there. Thank you for listening today.